Welcome to Engineering Innovations, the official podcast of Purdue University's Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering. I'm your host, Kristen Malavenda. Today, we're diving into a topic that affects us all, whether we realize it or not, software security. Every app you use, every update you download, every online transaction you make, I make a lot of those, depends on a complex software supply chain. And with that complexity comes risk. So joining me today is Dr. Santiago Torres Farias, an assistant professor in Purdue ECE, whose research focuses on securing systems, applied cryptography, and protecting the software development lifecycle. He leads projects like Intoto, a framework to secure how software is built and distributed, and has contributed to security tools used in major platforms like Docker. We'll talk about why software supply chain security matters, what vulnerabilities exist, and how his work is helping to make the digital world safer. Santiago, thanks so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure.
So let's start with the basics. And when you say software supply chain, what does that mean?
Well, it's, I guess the way that I would explain it so that everybody gets an intuitive idea of it is every time you consume something in the real world, it needs to go through a process to create that. So for example, say a bottle of pills or any type of medicine, we know that it goes through some extraction processes, some refinement processes, packaging, distribution, it eventually makes it into a counter in CDS. We walk in, we grab the bottle, you know the story.
Yeah.
It is no surprise that the software is made in the same way.
Okay.
We have a bunch of people extracting raw materials, in our case, it's ideas and thoughts. And then we refine them, process them, package them, distribute them, and put them on an app store or really any website on the internet for us to download it. It's the same.
Gotcha.
It's the same notion.
So what sparked your interest in this field, particularly why secure systems and not some other area of computer engineering?
Well, it's funny. I used to be a someone who wanted to do renewable energies,
mm-hmm.
and I actually did my undergraduate in EE, like straight down electrical engineering. For a little while, I wanted to do antennas. I wanted to do telecommunications. And around, I think, 2012, 2011, I realized that every single major event in history, at least at the time, was really inspired or influenced for really composed, at least in some part, with cybersecurity. So, for example, in 2012, there was a major election, presidential election in Mexico.
Yeah.
And there used to be this big hacker collective called Anonymous, right?
Yes.
And they, they were participating in sort of like a proselytizing and trying to question the result of the election. And back then, we're talking 40 years ago.
Yes.
Something I tell people is, well, every single election since, there's at least a sliver of like, hey, what happened with the cybersecurity here?
Yeah.
It's a fundamental element of democracy, right? And it's not only the elections, but really every interaction that we take every day, the amount of time that we spend on a phone or a computer, really affects us in different ways. And one of the reasons I wanted to be an engineer is because I really wanted to sort of like impact people's lives, especially in a positive way. So I cannot think of another discipline or sub-discipline within computer engineering or electrical engineering that's more sort of a touching into our personal lives than cybersecurity.
And you can see the impact that you're making. With a lot of the engineering, a lot of the interviews I do, people are working on things, but you might not realize the result of that for years and years, but you're doing stuff that like every day.
Yeah. And that's actually a philosophy that I have in my lab. I do believe that cybersecurity is such a pressing topic that we cannot afford to think 5 years down the line.
Right.
We need new ideas, we need innovation, and we need it now.
Yeah. So for people who aren't engineers, why should everyday people care about or think about the software supply chain security?
Well, every piece of software that you use, right, has a software supply chain. And something I do with some of my students in my DAB class, every semester or so, I go to the vending machine in the HWE building, mm-hmm. and I buy or HKN or somewhere. I buy a couple of them.
Yeah.
Then I put them on the table and I open some of them. Just put them open. And once the students come in, I go like, "Hey, free snacks, grab your snack," right? Some of them are open, some of them are closed. Every student will try to reach out for the closed one.
Okay.
And the reason is we have a very good intuition as to, well, that thing's open that
yeah.
we're Stanford with. I don't trust it, right? Now, the follow-up question is, when was the last time that you went to a vending machine? And when was the last time that you bought something online, for example?
Okay.
And we're increasingly moving into this, right? Mm-hmm. So you shouldn't trust an open candy bar that you found on the street.
Yep.
You shouldn't trust an open digital candy bar.
Okay.
That you opened on the internet.
Yes. That makes sense. That makes sense. When we hear about major hacks or data breaches in the news, how often are those connected to supply chain vulnerabilities?
Well, it's increasingly so, I would say. One of the interesting challenges with software supply chain is that hackers are finding out that they don't need to hack you. They
okay.
need to hack somebody who gives something to you.
Okay.
So it's a combination of, say, data science and sort of like a threat intelligence that most of these hackers just find the weakest link in mm-hmm. the chain, right?
Yeah,
so right. finding the weakest link will save them a lot of time, a lot of complexity, and a lot of the times it lets them be sneakier too. So going back to this sort of like physical supply chain metaphor, I don't know if you're familiar with the Tylenol murders that happened in Chicago in
mm-hmm.
the 1980s
yes, yeah.
or something. One of the things that are remarkable about that event, and just so everybody's on the same page, is that somebody walked into a couple of pharmacies in Chicago, opened the bottles of Tylenol, put cyanide on them, put them back in the counter. That's a supply chain attack.
Yep.
One of the things that are remarkable about it is we never knew who did it.
Right.
They were devastating.
Yeah.
They actually harmed a lot. And since there was this degree of indirection, it was really hard to carry out an investigation that allowed us to know this. As a precedent, well, now all bottles have this tamper-proof seal to really prevent this
right.
from happening. And we need these things in software too. Most major breaches, I would argue, have some component of supply chain nowadays. The SolarWinds hack, which is, I think, the biggest cybersecurity incident in this decade.
Yeah.
Allegedly, the Russians broke into a company called SolarWinds based in Austin, Texas. And then distributed a backdoor, some spy program, very sophisticated spy program
yep.
that then stole IRS data, Department of Defense, NASA, like you name it, a bunch of agencies, at least 9 acknowledged the breach. I wouldn't be surprised if there's more.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, yeah, those are the ones that are starting to make a splash. And the only thing that you need to do is find this weak link, and then you can make devastating damage.
Do you feel in a sense like you're constantly chasing the hackers, like you figure out what they're doing and abate that, and then they figured out something else?
Yeah, I think that's sort of like impossible to avoid
yeah.
in the world of cybersecurity. But in fact, have computers for decades, right? And we've been building secure systems for decades, for many, many decades. And hackers are really creative. That's one of the reasons I also like cybersecurity as a discipline too. It really asks of you to be creative
yeah.
in sort of like intelligent ways.
Yeah.
Think a little bit outside of the box. So this is to say, yeah, no, we build systems, they break them, but then that's going to keep us with the job.
Right. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. So tell us about InToto. What is it? How did it help protect software from being tampered with during development or distribution?
Yeah. So one way to look at InToto is, sorry, I'm leaning too much in this physical object.
No, it's fine.
It helps yeah. us though. Imagine, again, that you buy a snack, right? Like a bar of candy.
Yep.
And you look at the back of it and it says, this was produced in a facility that was processing peanuts, right? Now, you have a better way to know,
in a,
like your risks, right? If you're allergic to peanuts, you better not eat that candy.
Right.
It also has a nutritional label that tells you, well, just sort of the ingredients that are in there. And there's some like expectation that it will be almost exhaustive. For as long as there's a significant effect of like a significant ingredient there, it's going to be listed. It will also have a tamper-proof seal, right? Like you know if it was open.
Yeah.
InToto is basically the same in that it allows developers to produce little receipts that then you can aggregate to get a full picture
okay.
Of the software supply chain. And eventually you end up with a sort of like shrink-wrapped list of ingredients, warnings about the peanuts, and all of that useful information and software.
Okay. And what is InToto, like who are you working on that with?
So I think,
is it just a Purdue thing or is it?
Yes. Well, it is and it isn't. Again, I'm sort of like idealistically tied to this notion of it's a present.
Right.
And we need to really make sure that this innovation makes it to people out there.
Yeah.
So something that I do with the projects in my lab is we write the paper or we don't even write the paper. We build a system.
Mm-hmm.
Then we deploy it. and then we transfer it to the public.
Okay.
So in total, by now, has the thousands of developers throughout the industry, with different integrators and users and stakeholders.
Yeah.
Top of my head, we have collaborators from Intel that are very like dedicated.
Yeah.
To like protecting their software, but also the software of use, right?
Yeah.
And we have collaborators from Google, collaborators from, I believe, Citibank, maybe?
Okay.
I forget. It really is like a good
question. Yeah. You know, it's interesting, too, because you mentioned Intel, they want to secure their own systems, but they want to make sure that the systems that they use are also secure. So it's everybody is, and these companies is using it for themselves, but also having to use other software to get their job done.
Yeah. So another reason why I like softwares and computers is that it's all very immediate too. So we know that a supply chain is very complicated, right? We've had I think it was called Evergreen sort of incident in 2020,
yeah.
And this ship got like stuck,
right?
And then suddenly like everybody was, oh my god, like we're not gonna get products, right? This is because something that happens in Egypt or like in the Suez Canal,
right,
can affect whole world. The same happens with software, and I would say even more so because it moves so fast and it's so deeply interconnected that we really need to bring everybody on board and use Toto and deploy Toto on the receiving end, but also on the delivering end.
Yeah. So you also, I also mentioned SigStore.
Yeah.
So that's connected to InToto, correct? And does it solve a similar problem?
It is a similar problem. I would say that SigStore is what allows you to know that all of these little InToto receipts come from somebody you trust. So the way that it works is, you're familiar with like the loading with Google buttons, right?
Yes.
Like you go to Spotify or something,
mm-hmm,
instead of typing your password. Now, back in the day, we didn't have a way to know which developer did what,
or
at least it was a very onerous process. So SigStore is a framework that allows us to use this same infrastructure for like knowing who is who, to create cryptographic signatures over these like InToto statements, they're called.
Huh.
If you combine those two, then you know who's doing what,
okay,
and what are the consequences of what they're doing.
And it's easy, does it make it easier to track down issues?
Yeah. Track down activities, track down authors.
Obviously, securing the software supply chain is incredibly complex. Who are the main players involved in making it safer, or who do you think ultimately has a responsibility to make it safer? Is it developers, companies, the government?
I think it's everybody. It's a network, right?
Yeah.
Everybody's involved in some way, in some capacity. I would say that the government definitely needs to set standards, and they're working really hard, don't get me wrong. So they set standards, expectations, so that everybody plays fair with each other. I think developers and open source and industry need to or are communicating their activities so that consumers can also verify them. I think a gap that that I see right now is one of understanding and expectations. I think consumers of software need to be more demanding of of the company that produces software. This is not to say that they're not, but
right,
can be more, right?
Well, you don't know what to be demanding about if you don't know the issues. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
if I don't know what's the potential of happening, I don't know what to insist.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a problem. Something I struggle with a little bit is in communicating this to the broader audience, because it's a complicated topic, and it's one that, compared to the physical supply chain, it's really not that intuitive.
Right.
If you download something, you expect it to be what you expect.
Right.
But that's the crux of the problem.
We mentioned open source software a little bit. How does that fit into this picture? And since that's often built collaboratively, does it make it more vulnerable? Does it make it more secure?
I remember I was interviewed for after the SolarWinds attack.
Okay.
I forget which journalist or whatever, which outlet it was. But it's a question that comes off it. Like, should we do less open source, mm-hmm, or should this open source less or more safe? But I think the real answer to this is like, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
It's that ship has already sailed.
Yeah.
I cannot think of a single industry that is not using open source to some extent. I think this is a Dell laptop.
Mm-hmm.
Some Microsoft components are fully open source. If it was a MacBook, it would also have like the printer spooler or even some parts of the render engine, the browser. All of them are like major open source components.
Right.
I can't even tell you that the industries that you would be thinking they wouldn't do it, like say defense. Right. I know Lockheed Martin uses Intel, though, and they build a even for the F-35, I think they use some open source. They wanted to make sure that there was nothing phishing there.
Right. So the prevalence of open source and the complexity is hard for people to understand. What helps kind of keep it in check? Is it data science methods that keep it in check?
So that's something I'm really excited about. I believe that now that we build this sort of like foundation of traceability and sort of authentication through the software supply chain, now we can start doing the same things that we do for physical goods. So I remember something like a decade ago, I spoke with an FDA employee or officer. I don't know what the official role was, but he was telling me that, for example, for E. coli recalls, they actually have like sort of like spyglass over every single lettuce and farm. And what happens when somebody gets sick with E. coli, they get a couple of cases, they literally grab a little piece of the lettuce, put it on some sort of like DNA sequencing machine, and then it's like, oh, based on the sort of like the evolution of it, it came from this quantum.
That's crazy.
It is super, super interesting.
Yeah.
But you can imagine how useful it is for like
everybody. Absolutely.
So something I'm trying to combine now is this sort of Intoto 6-door plus data science. So if we can get the same spyglass into the software. If somebody gets hacked, we can say like which software farm, quote unquote, produced this piece of software. And how can we do a sort of like digital recall this software too?
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So moving on to applied cryptography. First of all, what is it? And what role does it play in securing systems?
So cryptography is just a branch of math. And the role that I would say it has, it really gives very strong assurance about the data or about the sort of like authentication. One very intuitive way to imagine it is we tap our card here at Purdue every time we walk into sort of like a high assurance place.
Yeah.
So that did a little cryptographic dance between your card and the reader. And that's because inside of the card, there's a little chip that has a special number that's a key.
Yep.
And through some sort of, I don't want to explain the math too much, but some sort of like mathematical equation.
Yep.
The reader says, oh, you have one of those special numbers. I know the number. Doesn't make sense?
Yes,
We can do the same for many things. And as a matter of fact, we use it to authenticate with a website. Every time you log into a website, in order to know that it's the right one, it's using some applied cryptographic methods, cryptographic signatures, namely, to show that it's the server, not a malicious server,
pretending
that server. You may have seen, sometimes you make an iPhone on a website and it says like, a risk ahead, or warning, or pretty Facebook. That's what's enabling this.
Okay.
It's an applied cryptography approach.
Interesting. Now, we all know artificial intelligence, machine learning, it's becoming more integrated into everybody's everyday lives. Are there new supply chain risks that are caused by that people should be aware of?
Yeah. So you were mentioning earlier that there's this sort of attackers and defenders, and they go back and forth. Ironically enough, just between like earlier this year and now, we've had a lot of supply chain attacks that are both using machine learning from attackers.
Yep.
So for example, there was a Trojan, sort of like a malicious piece of software that broke into a portion of the supply chain that was using ChatGPT to analyze what was it like critical information kind of where it was deployed. They're using machine learning for that. Another very sort of like scary aspect is that all of this software to make machine learning also has a supply chain.
Right.
Well, which is to say, I think it was last year, they tried to break into a major sort of like machine learning software library. I think it's developed by Google.
Okay.
In such a way that you use that library. Thankfully, nobody did. They caught it on time. All of the machine learning models that could have been developed, all of the AIs, would have been sort of like a malicious or like a insidiously...
Right. Not good intentions.
Exactly. I don't know how that looks, right? As defenders, there's also a lot of interesting work in using machine learning to defend for supply chain attacks. I think one of the best uses of machine learning, in my opinion, is the sort of anomaly detection, right? You look at the behavior, say using something like an Intoto on 6th door, and then you say, well, this is really fishy. What is this person doing? Do they have like any malicious intention? So definitely there's something there too.
Yeah. So using computers, people don't even think of like their smartphone as a computer, and people are just using it without thinking of where things are coming from or the supply chain. And I feel like you have older people who just are confused because they didn't grow up with computers. Then you have the middle section, which is has a healthy skepticism, but maybe doesn't know enough to even know what to be afraid of. And then you have like my kids and kids younger that are growing up, and this is just all a part of their lives. Like, didn't have to learn how to do it. It just exists. Is there a danger in just kind of using things and they exist, so you use them, but you don't really know or have any healthy skepticism about what's going on with them?
I think it's difficult to strike a balance here, but yeah. I think there needs to be a balance too. I don't know, every time I run into somebody that asks for like cybersecurity advice, I think the biggest piece of advice that I can give is be a little bit more mindful of all of the data that you're putting out there. And maybe you don't need that service.
Right.
I think that, but this goes writ large, right? I think younger generations are a little bit more happy to kind of like use new technologies.
Yes.
But older generations also sometimes, they engage in this in digital services without knowing what are the consequences. Right. Of it. Nobody's really fully safe, right?
Gotcha. So what do you think, looking ahead to the next 5-10 years, what are going to be the biggest challenges for supply chain security?
For supply chain security, I think in practice, we are going to have this coalescence of data. This is something I'm actively working on that will enable us to identify new threat actors. But we also have a lot of coalescence of technologies, right? As I was mentioning, AI meets supply chain. We're starting to see that combination. IoT meets supply chain. We're starting to see that combination. I would say AI produces software, right? But starts becoming part of the software supply chain.
Okay.
So it's almost like everything will mix in the next couple of years. And the newer challenges will be, I don't want to get philosophical, but if we're starting to have agents and AIs taking the supply chain, what are the expectations and guardrails that we can put on them?
Yeah.
And what are the systems that we can build to authenticate different sort of AI agents as they move through the network, right?
Yes, that makes sense. You talk about all these areas mixing. I feel like in your research, the interdisciplinary nature, all these different areas mixed together to solve a problem. What are the other areas that you would collaborate with the most, and how important is it to have that interdisciplinary?
Oh, it's super important. I would say that in my my philosophy, in the way that I'd like to do research, I really want to have impact, which means I like working a lot with Purdue faculty that do human aspect research.
Okay.
So for example, usability or sort of like what are the mental models that make the two at risk?
Yep.
And then bring it into the supply chain world. I think Purdue also has a collection of faculty that are very good at like criminal networks, sort of like understanding threat actors in that regard,
and
in particular the polytechnic of some really strong people in there.
Yeah.
So I also like to bring them into the fold. Definitely AI people, data science people, hardware design as well. It's another discipline that's combining.
Yeah.
We use software to design chips, and we use chips to run software.
Right.
So that also really calls for some of the Purdue faculty that do chip making to bring some perspective.
Yeah.
It
takes a village.
Yeah, it takes a village. It's a chain, right? Everybody's connected. And I would say that Purdue has very strong faculty in all of those disciplines.
Yeah.
So it's a great place to be.
What made you decide to go off into teaching and into academia as opposed to industry?
Yes. So that's a question that I get from my students a lot, especially because I work very closely with industry, right? It's like, why don't you just go there?
Right.
One of the reasons is I do want to make all of this public. Mm-hmm. And I want to determine the agenda. So when I developed Intoto, I was able to say, all of these companies should work together using this common format to protect the consumer.
Yep.
Right? When I developed Sixthdoor, I was like, all of these actors should work together to protect the consumer.
Right.
I feel that the academia allows me to set that tone.
Okay.
And allows me to really think about the problems from a sort of like fundamental level.
Yeah.
As opposed to industry, in which you do have the bottom line. And of course, they care about people, but they... Sometimes the forces at play do not allow them to have as much.
If they can't stay in business, then they can't do anything.
Exactly. And they're happy to take my stuff, right? Because I'm like, hey, I already did it. Do you want to use it?
Right.
Well, no, we don't need to pay all of those developers to come up with a new idea, right?
Right. When you're looking for students to work in your research group, what kind of qualities do you look for in a student that you think, okay, this is going to make a good addition to my research group?
Yeah, I think something I really look for is sort of like passion.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the students that I have, they have a very diverse skill set, but they're very driven.
Yeah.
And they get it. I don't know how to say it. They understand that this is a problem that requires us to be very diligent.
Yep.
And very concerned about improving people's lives. So that's what I'm looking for. How does that materialize? A lot of the times, do they work with extracurriculars?
Or okay.
Like, do they belong in a club that has like that focuses on societal impact? Do they have some experience developing software? Since we're trying to give this to industry, they're just not going to take whatever software.
Right.
They really want things up to their standard, which is to say, a lot of the times I also look for students that have some like industry experience.
Yes.
Or that did some internships and actually deployed something. I find that just knowing how hard it is to put product out
right.
there gives you a lot of perspective. It's a humbling experience.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm looking forward to.
There's a lot of failure in engineering too, because you have to hit a lot of roadblocks before you get the solution. How do you help your students realize that failure isn't an end? It's like a beginning. It's a jumping off point.
I think it's something I notice a lot with students is the first time they try to write a paper or build a system and sort of like it gets strong reviews or sort of like gets returned. It's again sort of like a growing moment because it really does challenge your assumptions. Though the perspective that I try to give students is there's really no other way. I really like reading philosophy. There's this book that I really like called The Myth of Sisyphus by Cooking. And we know The Myth of Sisyphus, right? It's a collection of essays. And one of them has this very beautiful quote that says, I'm going to paraphrase it's original in French. But it effectively says, you must imagine the sort of like infinitesimal moment when the rock is at the top. That is the fulfillment that Sisyphus gets. And he lives for that moment.
Right.
For us, like fleeting and short as can be, this is what makes his life worth living. And I think that really is it.
Yeah.
Think of that moment of success. Try to materialize it. And it's rock.
Yeah.
So it's going to take a little bit to lift.
So I'm going way back now, but when you were growing up, you seemed to be a very kind of intuitive, insightful person. When do you think, okay, engineering might be it? Or how did that transpire through your childhood that brought you to engineering?
Well, I'm going to relay that question to my mom. Because she likes telling the story that I will disassemble everything in the house.
Okay.
Right? And one day she was sleeping and I couldn't, but I always have trouble sleeping. So I took her alarm clock and I disassembled it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't assemble it. So she woke up like a little bit late for work and she was like, what's going on? Why did you do this? I was like, I don't know. I just want to know how this thing works.
Right.
And I think ever since she was kind of like, hey, it does sound like engineering to you.
Yeah.
What about disassembling the clock and assembling the clock?
Yeah.
So I think ever since, I really have been focused on trying to understand how things work. And I think in engineering, especially electrical engineering, computer engineering, really does let you go and take a look at how every single thing is made, because there's a computer on everything nowadays.
I think that people don't understand how creative engineering is. I think people think of, the pocket protector and, in the lab cave, not, interacting with the real world, but it really is incredibly creative.
Yeah, for sure. I, for example, something I tell people is I don't think I know an engineer that doesn't paint or play music or do some sort of like creative thing on the side. And I think it informs a lot of the times what they do in their day job.
Yeah.
They do it because they enjoy it, of course. But I think they use that also to kind of like drive the way that they approach problems too.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you do a lot of work. You're passionate about your work. So I'm sure sometimes it doesn't feel like work. But when you're not in the lab and you're not teaching, what are you doing to like decompress and enjoy yourself?
I like reading and I like playing guitar. I think that those are two things that just kind of like come naturally for many years to me. Lately, I jump back and forth between like fiction and nonfiction, depending on how I'm feeling. With the guitar, I mean, it's been really busy lately, so I had to put it aside.
Yeah.
That's usually like my me moment in a sense. Like I just grab the guitar, go into a room and it's very intimate for me. It's good to
get relax a little bit and forget about what's going on in the lab. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about software supply chain security today. I know I definitely understand it better.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for today's episode of Engineering Innovations, and thanks again for joining us. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the future episodes, and you can follow Purdue ECE on social media. You'll find those links in the show notes. And if you liked what you heard, please leave us a review and share the podcast with friends, colleagues, or anyone who wants to learn more about the innovations shaping our world. Thanks for listening. I'm Kristen Malavenda. We'll see you next time on Engineering Innovations.